Hey, good morning, everyone. It's Mojo with Kojo here. It's January 26, 2025, Sunday, January 26, 2025. It's about 11 a.m. I'm here with my actual brother, my blood brother, Shane Howard Johnson.
Yeah.
I'm gonna read over his bio real quick. Shane was born July 11th, 1972. He's 52 years old. Jesus is my savior and God. He's a husband of 32 years. He's married to Vicky. He's a father to two sons, Joshua 24, Caleb 20. He's my brother, and we have an older brother, Tony. He has two half siblings, Courtney and Billy. He served in the Marine Corps from 1990 to 1994. He served in Desert Storm and also was deployed to Somalia. So after he got out of the Marine Corps, he has been a restaurant GM and owner. He's a salesman right now. He has done or currently does do insurance, automobile, and real estate. He's still an ordained pastor. I currently manage the leads department for the largest real estate brokerage in Alachua County. I am a workaholic that works hard and plays harder. I enjoy life to the fullest and sometimes running over. His life motto is, "You can have anything in life you want if you will just help enough other people get what they want." And that's Zig Ziglar.
Yo.
Right, brother. Welcome. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for doing this with me and for me. The next goal is to get Tony on here. So I'll have both brothers on the podcast. Do you want to jump into the questions, or do you have anything that you want to add, or did I miss anything up on the intro?
No, perfect. I think the only thing I would add, Cole, is for your listening audience to hear that. I mean, I couldn't be prouder of the two brothers that I do have. My blood brothers, you and Tony. Tony's older. He's the oldest. I'm the middle. You're the youngest. But yeah, just super proud of my family, my brothers, and everything that we've all accomplished as a group. That a three little knuckleheads from Lockhart, Florida. Don't look it up. You won't find it on a map. And we got one brother sitting in Washington, D.C. area. We got one brother sitting in Buffalo, and we got one brother sitting in North Central Florida. And by most accounts, are all successful human beings. So I couldn't be prouder, especially coming out of, and I'm sure we may get into a little bit of it, buddy, but we don't have to. But coming out of the background, that we came out of. Yeah, for us to even be able to do this together, I'm just super proud. So I love you, man. There's not many humans that I could. You're in that top five of humans on this earth that I love at that level. So,
Well, thank you, brother. I appreciate that. And we
yeah,
love
man.
you too. And I always joke around and say that one day we should get together and write a book, a collective book.
Well, get on it because I'm already into mine. I've been told too many times in sharing stories and just having fun that people are go, and you're writing this into a book, right? JD Vance, not to get into politics, but he definitely beat us to it with Hillbilly Elegy. But I think we got one to rival that one.
For real.
So yeah, I love it. Let's do this. I'm super excited about this project for you, man.
Yeah, so am I. I've had a lot of positive feedback, so I hope it continues. Obviously, there probably will be some negative stuff here and there, but hey,
Who cares? Fuck
whatever.
them. Fuck them.
My heart's in the right place, so
Yeah.
that's all that matters.
Yeah.
All right, so first question is, how was your childhood?
Exciting, extreme, chaotic, beautiful, tragic. I mean, I think I sometimes hear stories like my wife's story, and I love her to death, but sometimes I hear her childhood, and it's not that it was perfect, but I'm like, oh, how boring. Because there was absolutely nothing boring about our childhood. Grew up on the in Orlando, north little community. I don't even know if you would want to call it a community. We call it here in Alachua County bedroom communities, but a little place called Lockhart, population of about 1500. But we were 20 minutes from Orlando, so but it was two separate worlds. I think it might be important to note that we kind of grew up in different households, you and I, because there was an age difference. I'm 52. I can't remember how old you are any given day, but
I'm
you're
41.
definitely younger. What's that?
I'm 41.
Okay, so
I'll be
yeah,
42 December
10,
5th.
11 year difference. So Tony and I grew up closer together. He's 5 years older than me, so obviously it. If I tell a story when I'm 6, Tony's 11, right? If I tell a story when I'm 15, Tony's 20. So he and I grew up in the same house in Orlando, in Lockhart, 2 bedroom, 1 bath house with 4 of us. So mom and dad, and again, the complication of when we say mom and dad, I'm always going to refer to those grandparents that raised us as mom and dad. That's who they are to me. And
And
it complicates what.
we're
What's
all
that?
adopted.
We're all
Myself and
adopted.
Shane and
We
Tony
all
are
got the same
adopted.
baby mama. Yep, we all got the same baby mama, all different baby daddies. And we're all on different journeys when it comes to that, but we were raised in the same basic household, just at different times. Grew up a pretty tough childhood, actually. It's not that there weren't moments of fun and joy and happiness, but there was. There was mental abuse. There was typical, by today's standards, that's what it labeled. Back then, we were just getting our ass beat. You know what I'm saying? Back then, mom and dad had, again, they were older. So, our bio, so I call our bio mom either Sharon or bio mom. So, bio mom had Tony when she was 16, obviously, which means she had me at 21 and then had you in her 30s. So, but we were definitely taken in. You probably don't know a lot of the stories, and maybe I share some things today that you heard for the first time. But yeah, I had fun. Baseball was our escape. So Tony was super good, drafted, highly looked at out of high school, second baseman. I came along behind him. I hated baseball, but he loved it. But And I remember having a conversation with him one day. He was like, "Why do you love this game so much? I hate this fucking game." And he said, "This game is my escape from that house." And then I got it. Okay, I love baseball for that, So, we both played baseball at pretty high levels. He kindly used to say, "As good as I am, Shane, you're better because you have me coaching you." So I played second base as well. But listen, dude, I grew up on the streets of Orlando. I grew up literally on the streets, man. Like, we grew up in that generation. Mom and dad were are depression parents. They grew up in the depression, so they, we were expected to be outside, never inside, until the streetlights came on. I mean, it was that stereotypical Gen X. Get outside. I don't want to see you, hear you, or know you exist until the streetlights come on. And you better not be late for dinner. Or you're going to get your ass beat. And so,
And there was no middle ground. There was either it was either it
I
was
don't know
either
a middle.
you're in that house by the time the lights come on, and if you're a second late, you're going to get your ass beat.
It's going to be a 30-minute ass whooping. And that's where the abuse would come in because those, it wasn't a spanking. It was a downright, I'm taking out the tragedy of my life on my children, ass beatings. But at the other side, see, our life, my life especially, has been a life of contradictions, because mom could be one of the most loving, beautiful human beings you'll ever meet. And no one fought the public harder on my behalf than my mother. No one did. Like she would take a person down physically or if they screwed with her children. And I have that, I love that because I have that mentality about the Marines. You and I are Marines. We can screw around with each other nonstop. But if somebody says something about the Marine, about my Marine brother, I'm going to take their head off, right? So anyway, I don't, I don't remember your friend's name, so you'll have to fill those gaps. But you were just talking to one of the guys about Mr. Rowe,
Oh, yeah, Craig. That was the last interview with my buddy Craig.
Craig. Okay. So I have those same experiences. They probably are different, or I know they're different because of the difference of his age and our age as you came along. I think he learned his lessons with us. So, by the way, that was a core silver
Silver
bullet.
bullet. Okay,
Yep. Those were core silver bullets. Know him well. And here's the problem for me. By the time, yeah, he started when we were probably 5, 6, 8 years old. By the time I'm 10, 12, he's buying 2 silver bullets and we're each drinking one. I would stumble home drunk.
He never did that with me. I mean, I don't have too many memories of him. I only have like a handful of memories with him.
Yeah.
And that the one memory that sticks out the most is sitting on that front porch.
Yeah.
You know, with him drinking the Coors or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah, he was cool as hell. So I had more extensive experiences with him because, again, everybody around us or adjacent to our lives seemed to understand what we were going through as kids, Tony and I. And so they bent over backwards and did really cool things to keep us away from home. Like, home was the one place we didn't want to ever be. So Mr. Rowe, I had baseball on Saturdays, so he knew I was out then. But every Sunday, I'd get up at 4:30, you know, in the Marines would say the ass crack of dawn, and I'd walk over there, and then he'd take me fishing with him. If there are 52 weeks in a year, it was probably 30 of those weeks. I'd go on Sunday and fish. That was church for me. Mm-hmm. I never fished. I hated fishing, but it was I read books voraciously. So I would just always have a book and I would be with him. It was just, it was, you know, and nothing weird. Today, somebody would kind of cock their eye sideways if somebody was telling that story about an old man today, but there was nothing weird. He was just a nice old man. And I actually liked him a lot. Yeah. He was a fun guy. Yeah, yep. He was the janitor at Lockhart Elementary School. I don't know if you knew that, but and his wife was the lunch lady, the lunch manager. And I don't remember his first name, but I'll always stick. Her first name was Marcel Rowe.
Oh, see, I never knew her name. I don't remember her. She may have been gone. Like, she may have passed away when I was in the picture.
She may have. I don't remember, but she was a beautiful human. And again, another one of those stories where when I came through the lunch line, I got extra, you know, and if I didn't have the money that day, because sometimes mom and dad didn't have it. And, you know, I was expected to kind of figure it out. We were feral children at some point, bro, you know, but she would always take care of me. I always had either two things to eat or, you know, if I didn't have the money, I at least had one. So again, Marcel, or, you know, I only know her name because all of her coworkers called her that. So it just stuck in my head as a cool, unique name. So, so Marcel and Mr. and Mrs. Rowe. And yeah.
So for the listening audience, I mean, I'll say this, I don't know if Shane agrees, but we were poor. We were dirt poor. There's no middle class blue collar. We were straight up poor.
Yeah, so Tony
government
and I
cheese, all that shit. Government peanut butter, all that shit.
Oh, yeah.
So.
And back then, though, I didn't really know that term. I didn't know we were poor. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody in our neighborhood was poor. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, some were, maybe Mr. and Mrs. Rowe were kind of middle class, but they weren't driving brand new cars either. And the house wasn't big. So, and our entire neighborhood, you know, was poor. And, you know, Tony and I had a beautiful moment as adults when we had kind of started to have some degree of success. We were at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse overlooking Reagan National Airport. So bay windows, Reagan National. I'm married. Vicky's there. Got the boys running around as toddlers and, you know, annoying everybody in the restaurant. But Tony and I kicked back with a cigar. And I said, hey, man, were we poor? And he laughed. I said, because I feel like I make a lot of money now. And I don't, like, did dad just not? He said, dude, we were so poor. he said, I went one time to the bank with him to get his check cash. And he said, you know, Tony, hand me my check out of the glove box. And Tony said, I'll never forget. I pulled it out and he was making a turn. So I had a moment to kind of look at it. And he got paid he worked for the city of Orlando. He got paid every 2 weeks and his check was $326. So,
which back then, I mean, that was in, you know, today's standards, that's not a lot of money at all, but back then that was,
but you know, about $600 a month. And I mean, that was after, I mean, we did have health insurance cause he did work for the city of Orlando.
Did
so.
Mom work or was she stay
mom
at home?
Mom was a flat ass hustler. Mom hustled. The reason we had half of what we did have was mom. Because she was a school crossing guard every year that I remember in Orlando. And she kept kids. And She was a straight hustler at the flea markets. So I, you know, if we could get out of it for baseball or fishing, we didn't go. But if there was nothing else, we had to get in the car and go to the flea markets. And she'd go to the Sanford flea market up there in north of Orlando, and she'd buy, you know, $10 worth of stuff, and before the end of the day, she'd flipped it into $50.
Nice.
So, you know, she probably brought in as much as Dad, just straight through hustling and three jobs. And, you know, she always wanted to have money and make sure we had something.
Right.
So,
right. So do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, I don't know if you want to bring up, like, was mom had Native American in her, right? Like, wasn't there like Cherokee blood in her or something? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I've got the paperwork cause of her. So she, just real, so yes. And you could definitely see it in her younger pictures. You know, so again, this is grandma, but she pretty much grew up Northwest Georgia, Rockmart area, up near the Cherokee Nation of North Georgia. It was never completely confirmed, like the way it's supposed to, for us to claim we're Native or we're Cherokee. Mm-hmm. You got to be on a certain roll, and I just never wanted to go down that road. Their oldest daughter Juanita, who passed away last year, she did a lot of that research, and I have the paperwork over in a filing cabinet that, you know, when she passed away, her daughter gave it to me last year. But so there's always been a notion that we're Native somewhere in there, but I never really claimed it to get any advantages or anything like that. And I never really wanted to take advantage, you know, or I didn't want to be a false claim, you know,
right.
much of our childhood was
false,
false
lies,
gray lies,
just cloudy, straight up ball face lies,
cloudy. I'm trying to give the, Murphy. I'm trying to give the dead some grace here. Okay?
Yeah. No. I mean, I joke around a lot about it, especially with like you and Tony, but I mean, for everything that mom and dad weren't, they were also, I knew they loved us. I knew they loved me, and I knew that they would do anything in their power to, you know, make sure that we, know, had what we needed for school and all that. It's different. It was so much different back then. You know, and it's so weird to say that, cause I'm, you know, I'm a father, I have two kids, and you're a father and you have two kids, and it's like night and day different. Like when Hayden and Kenley came along, I was like, I don't want to, you know, for everything that mom and dad were, I'm not going to put my kids through the, especially like the mental and physical abuse.
Right. We say, you know, sometimes people give you the example of how to be, and sometimes people give you the example of how not to be.
Yeah.
And I think our parents did a great job of showing us how not to be.
Right.
They were loving us in the best way they knew how.
Right.
And I often say, you know, when I'm working with folks and talking about it, that especially mom loved us violently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a good thing. You know, she, you know, I don't know. She lived. Listen, I know her story. I have researched and found out, and I visited the ancestors, if you will. I've been to Pennsylvania where Dad's from. I've been to North Georgia where Mom's from, and I've talked to generations in that of around her. And you know, listen, she ran away from home at 12. Dad ran away from home at 13. Right. Life was so bad for mom growing up that she ran at 12.
Right.
Life was so bad for dad growing up that he ran at 13. Neither one of them passed the sixth grade. And so,
which is pretty common for that time.
Correct.
From what I understand.
But can you imagine a young girl on the streets leaving at 12, what she's got to go through?
No.
You know, it's horrifying to think about for me. So when I look in her pictures of her and I see that blankness, that blackness in her eyes where there, I mean, not to be disrespectful, where there appears to be no soul, I can imagine the trauma it took to make her that way.
Right.
And so she rescued us. I mean, I thank God for them because they rescued us. I was abandoned at the hospital when I was 2 weeks old. Okay. if mom and dad, which was the emergency phone call on Sharon's emergency card to her parents, if her parents hadn't shown up and pulled me out of that hospital, where would I be? Right. My life might have been better, but likely my life would have been far worse. Right. So yeah. I can appreciate the serendipity of that in life. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. I grew up rough, but it could have been way rougher.
Right. Yeah. It could have been a lot worse for sure. 100%. I agree with that.
Yeah.
I know how many dad was like one of 12, right? Kid, like he had 12 siblings or something like that.
Lived, you know, the number was dad was one of 16. Mom was one of 18.
18.
Jeez. And remember, that's in a time when a lot didn't live. So I think he had wound up having 12 siblings that made it to adulthood. And Mom had something like 13 or 14 siblings that made it to adulthood.
That's crazy, man. That's crazy.
Yeah. But yeah, dad grew up in southern, you know, just south of Philadelphia, Washington, Pennsylvania, coal miners, you know, whatever movies you've seen about the old coal miner life, that's what he lived. Rough, tough. His life was. And so I think I got some of this from him, wanderlust, if you will. His life was, I got to do everything to get out of this. Mm-hmm. So that's why he ran away. And the ultimate story you may not know is they both met up in Jacksonville, Florida, when they were like 17. 18. Mm-mm. That's where they first met. Nice. Because they had both somehow found their way to Jacksonville, Florida.
That's funny.
Yeah. So, and then mom, you know, obviously ran too. So yeah, they wound up in Jacksonville. Dad went in the military, to kind of build a better life. They got married. He went in the military.
He served in the army, right?
Served actually in the original Army National Air Corps, which is now the Air Force.
Oh.
So back then he was in the Army, but today he would be called Air Force.
Oh, okay. I never knew that.
Yeah. And we have some. Go ahead.
He served in World War II, right?
Korea.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I found out some great things. I mean, I have a box here that's pretty eye opening and rattling a bit. But so it was towards the end of World War II. It was winding down. So he may have, no, he would have been too young for, I can't remember exactly. There was some little touch of World War II, but it was mainly Korea. But he wound up being, and it was, we had a weird connection that I wish he had talked about while he was alive. But at a certain point in the Marines, I became what's called a body man, which is the personal guard to a VIP. And I didn't know, but there was a picture that popped up in our little stash that we uncovered from their house when they died, of him on a limo running board from the 50s, right? Mm-hmm. So I did deeper and I pulled his military records. Come to find out, he was a body man for, you know, a pretty famous general. And I can't, it escapes me off the top of my mind right now. But so I like that we had that similarity, you know, and I didn't know about it, but I wish we could have talked about it. Dad wouldn't talk about his wartime experiences. Yeah. He was one of those guys that he said, son, you never want to know what's in my mind. And I kind of get that now, but we now know in 2025, that's called PTSD.
Right.
And we know we need to talk about it with somebody. Maybe you don't need to tell your kids the story, but you better damn sure tell somebody.
Yeah, he never talked about it with me, but I just and when we talk about them, you know, mom and dad, you know, again, they he passed away when I was what, 10?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
So there wasn't he never talked about that with me. But so are you good with that? Like, do you want to jump into the...
I mean, I think that kind of leads to how I wound up. So, this will transition into... I mean, I wrote some notes so I could keep us on track because you and I could... This could be a four-hour podcast just about our childhood, right?
Right.
So Orlando Chaotic, you know, there were some failed dreams there in the baseball world. I got kind of screwed over, and I wish school boards would understand it, what they're doing to individuals sometimes. So basically, I was set to go to Apopka High School to be the next, to be Tony's little brother like I had been all my life, and to be a superstar in baseball at Apopka High, which if anybody doesn't know, Apopka High School is like one of the top, if not the top baseball schools in the nation in high school. I mean, it's a machine down there. And literally, I got there for my 10th grade year. You know, I had to earn my way in. I was still working on becoming a starter. And then that summer between 10th and 11th, they rezoned Orlando. And now all of a sudden I was going from Apopka High School to Evans High School, which anybody that lives in Orlando just about vomited because back then, now Evans has since rebuilt, reshaped, and has changed, but it's in a place called Pine Hills that everybody in Orlando calls Crime Hills. And I mean, we've seen episodes of Cops filmed in Pine Hills, and it was a very hardcore, tough school. It wasn't that there were all races there, which there probably are at Apopka High School, or were, but it was so severely racially divided that there were basically gang fights every single day. I always said, if you want to know what Evans High School was when I was supposed to show up there, which I did go for about 6 months, what is that movie? Dangerous Minds.
Oh yeah.
Those movies that show those hardcore. I mean, listen, what do they call them? SRO, school resource officer.
Mm-hmm.
They had in the parking lot was an actual building which was a substation for Orlando Police Department. And at any given point, there were between 3 to 5 officers on, you know, in that building, ready to react. And, you know, that 6 months I was there that first semester, I literally saw, you know, Hispanic gangs jump the fences to come after a black gang, you know, so it was racial tensions all the time. And it was all gang related. It was not about racism. It was just gang related.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tough. And so part of my growing up, Cole, thank God you didn't have to experience this, but I mean, I think my first fight at school was literally in kindergarten. And, you know, I laugh about the Vin Diesel 500 fights. I probably had 500 fights before I got to high school. And then in that 6 months, I probably had another 40 fights in that 6 months. So I lived in the principal's office. And one day I screwed up, quote unquote, just this knucklehead guy, irrelevant of race, but he said something smart to me. You knew not to back down because you didn't want to be a punk. You didn't want to be a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
So I said something back. He had one of those hats that had the long, elongated, stupid looking bill on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he took it off and he smacked me, you know, basically bitch smacked me across the face. And I came up with such violence that, I mean, 30 seconds, his face was blood. I just remember being over him, just pounding and teacher having to pull me off. And so I go to the office, but the dean of students was this kid's father. And so I'm sitting in the office. He slams the door. He walks over and he open-handedly bitch slaps me across the face. And reactionary, of course, but I had two. I just remember we were about to do a Scantron test. So I had two number two pencils sharpened in my hand, and I stabbed him in the thigh with those two pencils.
Oh, damn.
So we got this huge incident. I've stabbed the dean.
Right.
But he slapped me physically first. Long story short, I get expelled from the city, from Orange County schools. I am no longer able to attend school anywhere in Orange County.
Right.
So my parents, dad had, was thinking about retiring. He went ahead and retired, and they bought 10 acres up in Fort White. So if you ever wanted to know the story about how they wound up in Fort White, Florida, mm-hmm. it's because mom, they were doing it for me. Again, here's this contradictory love, right? They were hugely abusive people, but they were willing to uproot their lives and to ensure that I got an education.
Right.
So we came up to Columbia County, Florida, so I took that 6 months off that remaining semester and went to night school and then right back into 11th grade. So I did 11th and 12th grade at Columbia High School.
In
Fort White. Well, Columbia High School is in Lake City, that Columbia County area.
Right.
So, and I still played baseball. I still loved it, but I had to get out, bro. I had to get out. I had a girlfriend that I was, toxically in love with. You probably remember Christina.
I remember her.
So it's crazy. Again, my life has been nuts, man. So I start going with a friend in a neighborhood up in Columbia County named Roger. Somehow one day we have this vision that we want to be in the military. So we go up to the recruiting station in Lake City. This is probably late 11th grade heading into 12th grade. I always wanted to be a SEAL at first, you know, all right. So I'm talking to the Navy guys and a Marine recruiter, and he did some bad shit as the history of recruiters can be. So I don't want to name him. I still remember his name, but yeah. I don't want to name him. But he walked by and heard me and waited outside till I walked out. And he said, "Hey, if you really want to be a badass, you should be a Marine." And I don't know. I just had that attitude that, you know, and so I started working with him. We did that whole, I'd show up every, you know, Sunday to run with him, PT.
Yeah. kind of like the delayed entry program.
It was. I didn't technically sign delayed entry.
Right.
But so finally come to the, I graduate. I've got an opportunity. So I progressed well enough in baseball that I'd gotten a couple of offers. So long story short, my senior year at the summer of my senior year, I decided I'm out of here. I don't want anything to do with this. And I had a Greyhound bus station ticket to Miami because I had an official visit with the University of Miami to play baseball.
Oh, nice.
And so I went to the Greyhound bus station on a particular day. Well, this was actually heading into September by now. And I just asked the guy behind the counter at the bus station. I said, "How far north will this get me?" And he said, "Where are you trying to go?" And I said, "Paris Island, South Carolina." And he goes, "You want to be a Marine?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You can't start there. You got to start in Jacksonville at MEPS."
Right.
And I said, "Okay." He said, "I'm a Marine. This ticket will get you there. If it's missing anything, I'll pay the difference." And so he ensured I had a ticket to MEPS. I got on a bus, went to MEPS, spent like 4 days there because I had an eye issue. I have what's called lazy eyelids, stupid name, but they thought I was high all the time. Everybody growing up thought look at me now. I look like I'm high all the time. Right? I'm not. I've literally never done drugs. I went MEPS. The recruiter, when I say he fucked me over, he fucked Christina. He did her three or four times. You know, he was a dirty dude, but then he did hook me up as I was called him, said, "I'm in, you know, MEPS." He said, "Have you signed anything?" I said, "No." He said, "Let me hook you up." So he gave me a MOS called Combat Engineer, knew nothing about it, but it gave me a $5,000 signing bonus. Cause I was just going to go be a grunt. I wanted to be the Marine on the picture.
Right.
0311. And he said, "Let me hook you up." Maybe he felt bad for taking my girlfriend or whatever, or, you know, doing me dirty.
Yeah.
But, we were all messed up kids, so I get it. But, the problem was he was probably 24 and she was 16, 17. So that's a bit of a problem. So I wind up going to Paris Island, September 4th, 1990. And, so I was there 2 weeks, and then I get called into the base general's office because there's an APB missing persons for me in Florida because I never told mom or dad where I was going.
Oh, shit.
The last anybody knew was I was getting on a Greyhound to go to Miami. I never showed, you know, they thought I got lost down there or killed down there. So the base general made me call mom and dad. And again, that whole first phone call, I just called the recruiter. I didn't call mom and dad, and then, you know, I started my journey in the Marine Corps, which Tony and I have such a relationship. I love him to death. He's God, one of the most special people on earth to me. He's in the Air Force at the time. He's learning because Desert Shield is cranking up at this point. So he's learning Arabic languages. The asshole sends me a letter written in Arabic to boot camp when we're going to war with an Arabic nation. So I get my second visit to the base commander's office to translate a letter that he had written in Arabic. So I had to wait for an Arabic translator to be flown in from Cherry Point.
Oh, wow.
To translate that it was just my brother saying, "Hey, what's up, dude? I hope you don't get in too much trouble for this letter."
So it was kind of like a joke.
It was 100% a joke. It wasn't very funny until 20 years later.
Right.
You know,
right.
But that's been our, you know, we've had so much fun together and played off each other with stuff like that. And I guess you would call us that close that we can do that to each other. But anyway, yeah, then I became a Marine, right? Graduated. I think you were at my graduation. Mm-hmm. I think.
I remember it being cold. Right.
Yep. Yeah, very cool.
I was like 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah, you were a little guy. I think I got one picture of you there, and then I came to yours, obviously.
Yep.
But, so then I began my Marine journey. I don't talk a lot about the Marine life that much. Mm-hmm. You know, like I told you in a call not too long ago, probably the first 10 years after I got out, I'm not ashamed of it. I'm very proud of what I did, and our family has served our nation for almost 200 years, if you look at our ancestry through the Civil War. And we can trace ancestors all the way back to the War for Independence. So we have done our duty, you know, and I told my sons it stops with me, that they're done. they have no obligation, that they will break the chain. Yeah. We're not serving this country this way anymore. I spent the first 10 years after I got out. I have friends from that 10-year period that the first time I said I was a Marine, they were shocked that I had never mentioned it. Because I got influenced by a great captain that I worked for, who said, "Young man, when you leave, make sure the Marines isn't the greatest thing you've ever done."
Right.
And that really stuck with me. And I was like, you know what? This was an amazing thing I just finished. I will be forever proud of it, but I got to make sure this wasn't the greatest. I'm not going to be the 70-year-old at the VFW talking about the good old days.
Right.
You know?
Right.
You know, so, and I've been proud now at 52. I can honestly say the Marines is one of the greatest things I ever did, but it's not the greatest thing I ever did. Mm-hmm. So, I did Desert Storm. By the time I hit, it had moved and it was Desert Storm. I was there at the tail end of it. Let's not be misleading in any way. Mm-hmm. It was such a damn fast war that I arrived at 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines. 7 days later, we got on we headed out. We went overseas. We did Desert Storm for a whopping maybe 15, 20 days to mop it up, to hand it back over, you know, to the Army. If anybody doesn't know, that's the way it works. The Marines are first to fight. Then the Army comes back in and cleans up the mess we made. And so they're the occupiers. We're the takers. So we left and went on immediately rolled into a Mediterranean deployment. So spent 5.5, 6 months in the Med, doing the Med deployment.
So you were on a MEU, right?
I was, 22nd.
Isn't that what that's called?
Yeah, Marine Expeditionary Unit. That was the 22nd MEU, and then I did the 24th MEU 2 years later.
Oh, very nice. Very
24th
nice.
MEU was Somalia. So, yeah, 22nd MEU. Listen, the chaos of being a Marine on a Mediterranean deployment, if you've heard stories about it, about the girls, about the life, they're not true. It's more.
crazier?
Yeah, we purposely withhold 90% of those stories because no one would believe us.
Yeah.
So I got that life, got back, had this weird incident that you were heavily involved in, where weird meaning or very beautiful moment, where basically I meet my future wife through you.
Yep. And I remember that. I brought you and Tony into for show and tell.
Show and tell. And And I met Vicky Hollingsworth, and you overheard funny stuff. I mean, we have a longer version we share with friends, but the short version is you overheard Tony and I talking trash as men. He was Air Force. I was Marine. And we forgot our little fourth grade brother was sitting in the back seat. Overhearing us talking trash about this hot ass chick that we had just met. There was this teacher. I didn't understand the process. I didn't realize she was interning her senior year of college, but you came running home the next day. You did some little magic at school the next day and pressured her into giving her phone number for her Marine brother. And you came running home the next day. By the way, if I had time, I'd go get it. We still have that note with her name and phone number on it. It's pressed into her Bible. But yeah. So that began the journey of me meeting, dating, eventually marrying Vicky.
You're welcome.
No, huge thanks. I have no problem saying that. I mean, I was teasing.
I'm teasing.
No, it is a huge thank you because I was a Marine. I was headed back to deployment. I was gone. Right. I was 48 hours later, I was in Jacksonville, North Carolina. You know, so I wouldn't have pursued her. She's beautiful. She was definitely like, I could marry that chick.
Mm.
Not only just everything perfect about her. Even at that moment.
Right.
But I was about to go a different, back into my world.
Right.
Where none of the girls would measure up to her, but there were plenty of girls.
Right.
So I wasn't, I probably wouldn't have pursued that back, but I at least did call her
mm-hmm.
in that 48 hour window before I left. Asked her out. She said no. And that pissed me off. So then that created the pursuit. Shane Johnson at 19, 20 years old, Marine, did not, I mean, now listen, if people take this out of context, I've never molested, raped, or in any way forced a woman to have sex with me, but I didn't take no for an answer the first time for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I pursued who I wanted to pursue.
Right.
And so anyway, get out of that weird bubble. We got married. We've been married 32 years this year, so
right.
We're very happy together.
And but, yeah. You guys at one particular point in time kind of raised me for a few years as well.
Yeah, I got out. I had a reenlistment package being put together at that point. I was going to be a lifer. I love the Marine Corps. Listen, mm-hmm. I knew all. Listen, I hear it. I know all the things to hate about it. I hated all of them. But guess what? They were not worse than the life I'd already grown up in.
Right.
But on top of it, I got to travel the world, whatever, have relationships with some of the most beautiful exotic women in the world. I was having the time of my life, so I was ready to do this for 20 years.
Right.
And then I met Vicky, and she put a stop to all of it because mm-hmm. I knew immediately I wanted that woman as my wife and the mother of my children.
Right.
Because until I met her, I had the opinion that Tony had until recently that we shouldn't have kids. Like the Johnson boys should not be reproducing in this world.
Procreating.
Not because we're bad, but because we don't know how to parent a child.
Right.
And so Vicky, I give her all the credit for me knowing how to do it. So long story short, we get out. I come back to Gainesville.
Do you remember what year you got out?
Yeah, 94.
94.
So I got extended by about 5 months. So late 94.
I got you.
And then we come back to Gainesville because her dad had convinced me to, you know, to go into college. And again, I grew up brainwashed by my dad growing up that, you know, the Johnson boys don't go to college. We're blue collar guys. Mm-hmm. And so I attempted college. I did not eventually graduate, but I attempted it for a couple years there. But enjoyed life, worked at restaurants. I became a GM at McDonald's. You know, I advanced very quickly because of the Marine mentality and the, you know, I'm a systems guy. I'm very organized anyway. So I very quickly progressed in the McDonald's system and was really doing well in, you know, so I was in college with kids who were graduating hoping to make $40,000 a year and I was already making $70,000 a year.
Right.
And I was like, okay, this sounds stupid. So I kind of went that mm-hmm. way. And I'm 52. I still don't have a degree, but do quite well. So I'm not really worried about that.
Right.
Yeah. Right. But I do have a dream sometimes to go back, but to do it, but definitely not for the income.
Right.
But yeah, somewhere in there, dad died. We were able to be around 10. Him. Yeah. You were living with mom and dad.
Yep.
Then that was a very special year. I hate to say it that way, but the year, so mom died a year exactly after dad died, like within days of 1 year anniversary. And I got to spend some really quality time with her and you, because I hadn't been around you for a while. And you were a kid, right? 10, 11, 12. Yeah. So mom died somewhere within that year. And then you went with, for whatever reason, I don't even remember the discussion. So a fog of memory back then. But Tony took you in originally, and you moved yep. with him to Tallahassee.
Yep.
Yep. And no blame on him at all. For some reason that didn't work out well for him. And mm-hmm. we can now say, I now know it was because of who he was married to at the time, but he was married to his high school sweetheart, and mm-hmm. you know, they had a mutually, you know, what did they call it? A codependent relationship. So mm-hmm. Things didn't go well. So I wound up coming and kind of rescuing you from that. Not again, never to imply Tony did something wrong, but the environment just wasn't good for you. And so Vicky and I agreed, and to her credit, man, listen, got to give her all the credit that it was never a discussion or an argument or an issue. I was like, I really think we need to go get Cole. And she said, yeah, I'm wondering why we haven't yet. And so we went and got you. You spent the last, I don't know, till 18, 19, somewhere you yep. spent it with us. Hopefully we did okay. It was tough on all of us because then Vicky was getting pregnant at the time. And
yep.
Joshua, I think you were there for at least the first year of Joshua's birth.
Yep.
I mean, you were our kid. You were in our house. I mean, you were my brother, but, you know, I always say it this way, at least for the teenage years, which is probably a bad idea, but at least for the teenage years, you were my experiment of could I father. You know, could I help father a kid? And so, yeah. And then, you know, one point you left, you moved out, you kind of went on your own, you did some stuff, you know, that's your story to tell. I think you were at one point at McDonald's as well.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden you're in the Marines. And yep. so from there, I just began a journey of, you know, I was in restaurants for 15 years. I did McDonald's. I switched over to Chick-fil-A as a GM. Then I went over to a local place here. Some folks in Texas know this name, Grandy's.
Yep.
And was there for 8 years. And then through that, my father-in-law and the owner, Dave Miles, helped me buy my own restaurant. And so, and actually, I think you helped me manage that for a period of time.
Yeah, I was the GM for, I don't know, a couple of years, I think, right?
Yeah, I want to say, yeah. I mean, we were doing okay. We were paying the bills.
Yep.
I came home one day. Vicky and the boys were doing their thing, getting ready to go. I said, hey, let me get dressed real quick and I'll join you. And she's like, I mean, we had a really brutal kind of come to Jesus moment. She just looked at me and she said, and I thank her for this. It sounds harsh, but I thank her for saying it because I wouldn't have heard it otherwise. She said, you know, Shane, we really don't need anything but your paycheck. We're good. We've learned to do this on our own. And that kind of crushed me because the one thing I didn't want to ever be was divorced. Like if we're not, she's not a terrible human. She's not, you know, a bad wife. She's not a bad mother. I love her to death. What do I do about this? So I went and talked to my pastor. And he said, you're going to have to make a decision, your restaurant or your wife in family. And I wasn't going to do that to my sons. So I closed it within like 36 hours. Like I shut it down fast. And
Lord Munchies, right?
Was it Lord name of the Munchies restaurant? Pizza. Yeah, we did. I still have the recipes. I still make that stuff from time to time. Some of the best pizza on earth. And
yeah.
But anyway, so yeah. I walked over to the church. My father-in-law, who'd made some money, I mean, he's a wealthy guy, said, I'll take care of your bills for a couple of years. Let's figure out what you want to do in life. So I walked over to the church, and the pastor's like, I got something. You're good with organization. You're good at sports. I got this organization that we've started called Pray Then Play Sports, which is basically a youth league.
I remember
and
that.
He said, why don't you run this for a little while until you get your feet under you? I ran that thing for 5 years.
Yeah.
Eventually, they brought me on staff. Yeah, so I just kind of started growing there. I wound up getting ordained at that point. Then wind up with another church for about 7 years as a youth pastor.
Parkside?
Parkview. Yep. God, you remember those things. That's awesome. So I was at Parkview for a number of years, 7 years. Loved the impact I had on youth and you know, helping them develop. I think I spent as much time teaching them how to be humans as well as, you know, following Jesus type stuff, you know. I used to tell them, stop panicking about the next 2 years. Or stop panicking about who you're going to be the rest of your life. Just focus on the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I've had youth come back to me and say, that was probably one of the most, life-changing things. Cause they were, my parents, I got to be a doctor. This is what I got to be in life. And it's like, no, you're 18. Chill the hell out. there's an old saying I used to love, or I still love, but it's like, a lot of people don't know what they want to be when they're 18, and they shouldn't. Some of the most interesting people I know now don't know what they want to be when they're 40. And they're 40, you know? Like, so I've kind of lived that degree of life. So did restaurants all the way to that until I shut mine down to save my marriage, which I was thankfully able to do. And we grew closer than ever from that. And I think for her to realize that I was willing to sacrifice something for her. You know, and then, then my father-in-law, Wayne, who is the second father to me, you know, if my dad that adopted me, raised me, I always liken it to the book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So I had my poor dad. This was my rich dad.
Yeah.
Who taught me about money, something I never learned about, taught me about being successful, told me I could be a salesman, which is something I'd never heard of or thought about, you know.
Right.
And then I found out I'm damn good at it. And so built a couple of different businesses and careers over being, you know, a successful salesperson. And then, you know, now I've kind of wanted to settle down. Empty nesters, both boys moved out, you know, a couple months ago. So it's just Vicky and I, and I was in cars. I was in auto industry, and as salesman or sales manager, you're 7 day a week, 12, 15 hour days. And I'm 52. I want to spend some quality time with my wife again.
Yeah.
So I found this beautiful opportunity to work for the number one residential realtor in Alachua County, Betsy Papine. She's a rock star. She's an icon. She's a legend. And I got the opportunity and said yes. So that's been 6 months now, 5 months that I've been running this program for her. And we're having huge success. You know, we set numbers we didn't expect to set ending the year, and we're already off to a hell of a start at the beginning of the year. So very proud of the work, but also proud to be able to come home at 5, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and then be off Saturday and Sunday. So here I am, you know, if I was at the dealership, you and I'd be having this interview in my dealership office, and I'd be screaming at people not to be knocking on my door because I told you I needed an hour. Right? But now it's Sunday morning. I'm at home. Vicky went to church, and I jumped on with my brother, and then we'll spend the afternoon together. You know, nice. So that's where I'm at today.
Very nice.
I think I just took you on a bit of a journey. What chaotic, crazy stuff can I tell you in the middle of all that?
I think one question that I would like to ask is what are some of the life lessons that the Marine Corps instilled in you?
So, I say it this way, probably number one, first, the Marines was all about proving something to myself, right? That I could do something. I arrived, and I think this is a story I've heard numerous times. It's probably a story for most Marines. You arrive in boot camp, and very shortly you go, why the fuck did I do this?
Yep.
But I believe in that kind of stoic philosopher kind of vision of burn the boats. Like, you know, if you're going to go to war, burn the boat so you can't go back.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I had burned all the boats, meaning I couldn't go home. Right. Not a Marine. Like, this was no option. Mm-hmm. And that allowed me to endure, you know, the quasi torture I went in the 90s, early, you know, 89, 90, 91.
It was a different Marine Corps back then.
they were still beating you. I had stitches my 10th day in. I had stitches in my right eye because I didn't lock my M16 to the rack. And I mean, just instinctually, the drill, our heavy was brutal. He was a didn't know this at the time, he was Force Recon Marine. He actually died in Desert Storm. And so he pulled it off the rack and just, I mean, I caught the front sight right in the right, just above my right eye, and had three stitches within an hour. So yeah, they were still beating people. They were still punching. They were, you know, they generally would hit where it wouldn't leave a mark, but he had forgotten himself and he left a mark.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, like, I mean, everything that you're taught, and this is just my experience with the Marine Corps boot camp and all that stuff, all that is for a reason. Like, there is a reason, there is a method 100%. For everything that those, you know, drill instructors do.
Absolutely. I agree. And Sergeant Weathers was his name, and God, I love him. He's still a very hugely influential person from my early, life, you know, as a young man. But again, we tragically lost him in Desert Storm. He shared with us when we were on the rifle range, you know, it slows down. They can't stress you on the rifle range because you got loaded guns, right? So we had these like work parties, and there were six or seven of us that he loved to death. And I was one of them. Listen, man, I don't come off that way. Again, I'm a life of contradictions, but I'm a maniac. I don't have many fears, and I will, if we walk up to the edge of a cliff and there's a river below, before you said, should we jump? I'm already jumping, you know, kind of person. And so we were in a van, I'll never forget, work party. And he just kind of pulled over on the side of the road there at Parris Island and just kind of talked to us for about 30 minutes and told us, you're the guys that'll make it. This is why we do what we do. And he gave us the inside baseball of why they did what they did. And that was from there, we knew we were sailing to graduation.
Mm-hmm.
What did I learn? You know, focus. You know, there's an incident recently in the news, you know, flag goes by a Marine at the White House and it knocks his cover back. He looks like a shit, you know, for you and I, he looks like a shitbird, you know, Marine, cause he's back on the block with his cover knocked with his back.
Homies. Yeah.
And people are like, why isn't he putting it back? And we know why. Cause he's extremely disciplined and focused, and he knows he can't.
Right.
Well, I've been in situations now. I know why they train that, because in combat, you got to be extremely focused.
Right.
And I tell the story of taking, you know, I was providing suppressive fire. I needed to be on task, and I was in the desert, and we have scorpions in Florida that are about the size of a roach. In the desert, they have scorpions that are bigger than your hand.
Right.
And the ones in Florida will make you ache a little in the spot where they hit. The ones in the desert will put you down, if not kill you. I don't think they'll kill you, but they'll put you down for a few days.
Right.
But I was in a situation where I was having to be laser focused. Some important shit was going on. I was having to lay down suppressive fire, and the largest scorpion I've ever seen up close in my life walked across my left hand. Well, what do we got to be? We got to be focused.
Right.
That's just a scorpion walking across a rock,
right?
Which is my hand,
right?
But you can't flinch, you can't panic. So that's everything they were ingraining us in boot camp when they would run us through the Marine shower, which was a made up PVC, thing, like, almost like a car wash, but they would be like six of them in a row. You'd run through. By the time you got to the end, you were soaking ass wet,
right.
And then they put you in the pit for an hour.
Right.
Now you got sand in your ass crack and under your balls and, you know, up in your armpits and in your eyelids. And now here come the Parris Island National Bird, which is a sand gnat, sand flea.
Sand fleas.
They're crawling in your ear. They're crawling across your eyeballs because your eyes are open and you can't even blink to get rid of them.
Right.
So, and if you do, you just extended it for an hour.
Right.
Right? Right. So the brutality of it, and you go, they're torturing us. No, they're teaching you levels of discipline that most humans can't accomplish. And if you can't do it, you're not going to make it.
Right.
We arrived at boot camp with 98. I'll never forget these numbers. And we graduated 34.
Damn.
So at that time, the attrition rate was pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And listen, every single morning they rolled out the, they did reveille, they did the trash cans thrown down the barracks. And by the time you came out of the shower, you know, your 5 minutes to shit, shower, shave, and be dressed.
Right.
Standing online, they would roll the TV out and they would turn on CNN and the news about the buildup and the war with Iraq was coming. And we were doing Desert Shield at the time. And they would point at it every single morning, Cole. Every single morning, they would point out and go, this is where we're preparing you to go to die.
Right. Right.
You know, so it was ingrained in us. You boys are going to war and we're taking this shit seriously. And if you don't have what it takes, it's not about you. But if you die, that might cost the Marine next to you to die. And so we're not thinking about you. We give a shit less about you. We care about the Marine next to you and we want him to live. Right. And I didn't know until later, but Sergeant Weathers would often say, you may be the one covering my six.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it wound up being true. I mean, I went to Desert Storm. He was in Desert Storm and died there. So, you know, that shit was all real. Right.
Right. Right.
So what did I learn? That was your question. Focus. Right.
Yeah.
The ability, maybe it's wrong, but the ability to believe I can do anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I've cliff dove in Spain, you know, I've jumped off a cliff that was 100 feet high. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd never thought at 15, if you told me that at 15, I'd tell you, you were insane.
Right.
You know? So, I'm not intimidated by anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have respect. I absolutely love who I work for, you know, and what I can learn from her. Mm-hmm. But I would never say I'm intimidated by anybody. Mm-hmm. I had a few moments in the Marines. I had one in particular that I think it's valuable. I want nobody to ever have to go through it, but I think it's valuable. I had that moment where my few guys and I looked at each other and we said, well, this is where we go. This is where we die. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to die, we're going to die in a blaze of glory. We're going to die on our feet shooting.
Right.
And we didn't. But we had that moment of death washing over us,
mm-hmm.
knowing it's happening before it comes and being okay with that.
Right.
That's a pretty damn freeing feeling. Right. So what did I got that coming out of the Marines where I don't have a death wish, but I don't fear death anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't have a death wish. I want to see my sons. I've seen them graduate. I want to see them get married. You know, I have wants and desires. And I'm not going to needlessly put myself, I'm very smart about, you know, life and I value it. So I don't want to put myself in a situation where I'm going to necessarily, my life is at risk, but I certainly have no fear of it.
Right. So, right.
And now added to that, the bonus of firmly believing, you know, in Jesus and where I'm headed afterwards. Okay, cool. I'm not in a rush to meet him, but I'll be okay when I do.
Right.
I think that comes out of that those moments in the Marines that, you know, combat units, if you face that, you genuinely, you know, have that moment. So focus, that kind of embracing of death that I've seen grown people struggle with as their life was ending, you know, through cancer or whatever. I think that kind of thing. I'm mission oriented. I've told every job and every boss and everywhere I've been. And when I've run teams, I'm a Marine. So point me in a direction of the battle and say, go. And I'm gone. Yeah, I'm going. So right now we're on a mission at my job. I treat it like a Marine mission. It's planned. We do the OPSEC and we do everything and we go. And you know what? 80% of the time we accomplish it.
Right.
And when we don't, just like Marines, we don't retreat. We just turn and fight in a different direction. Right. So, yeah, you know, I call it pivoting. So I learned a great deal about pivoting. You know, you learn that you put together the best plans on earth, and then when the first bullet comes or the first phone call happens or whatever it is, that it's all gone.
Right.
But you're at least trained and you at least had a plan that you can kind of operate around. So I don't do anything willy-nilly. Everything's planned,
but I can also improvise, adapt, and overcome in the moment too. So that's probably the Marine lesson.
So before we go, I would like to just say, you know, I don't know if I've ever said this, and, you know, shame on me for if I haven't, but
there is no shame, bro.
You know, I would like to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for, you know, being there for me, you and Vicky and Tony, and never giving up on me and always, you know, without a shadow of doubt, you guys have always had my back. You've always supported me. So, you know, without you guys, without you and Vicky and Tony, I don't know where I'd be today, and mom and dad too, for that matter. But, you know, if it had not been for you guys, I don't know if I'd be sitting here right now. So, you know, thank you. I know it wasn't easy. I know it wasn't, I know it wasn't easy to help raise me, especially in the teenage years. I know there was, you know, stuff that happened and all that jazz, but, you know, all that to say again, you know, thank you for being there for me and instilling, you know, certain things in me and, you know, showing me that I could do it and that I can do it and all that jazz.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, it's been our honor and our pleasure, dude. The great times and the good things far outweigh any of the bad that we had, and we figured it out, and we kept our, you know, blood's everything, you know, blood is everything, and we're anchored together through that blood, and we're here, man. Like, it doesn't matter going in the past and going forward, always going to be there for you, man. Fully support you, 100%. Anyway, you know, through this endeavor, through whatever's going on, we got your back, man. And Tony, I know without him, he'll say the same thing. And I know because he's been there for me. He's saved my life literally in the last 5 years. So he's been amazing. So proud to have you three as brothers, you know. And we didn't get into this journey here. And like I said, you and I can do. We could probably do a year worth of podcasts on family and
yeah.
I've just discovered my biological father at the age of 52. So I am on a journey of discovering a new family.
Right.
But nothing replaces my core first blood family. The three of us, you know, we are the Johnson boys and we're getting it done. Yep. Hey, real quick, I know we're going to end it, so I don't want to end it on a sad note. Do you know what VetTix is?
VetTix, yeah. I've heard of it. I've never used them.
Oh, God.
But I know what it is. Yeah.
If the guys, if the vets, you know, I say guys, I mean that lovingly for the girls, too, because I served with some badass female Marines. So anytime we say guys, we said guys in the Marines, too, when there was a room full of girls with us, too.
Right,
so,
right.
For the guys out there serving the vets, yeah, I highly recommend it. You know, if we give them anything positive, hopefully they learn something from our story, but also something positive if they've never heard about it. You really need to look into VetTix. It's really cool, VetTix, and it's basically set aside free tickets to all kinds of events. From, right. I mean, there were VetTix available for the Super Bowl. They got snatched up pretty quickly, but
wow.
But I see regularly, so I bet there's VetTix for the Buffalo games, but VetTix for the whoever you guys' hockey team is. I don't do hockey.
The Sabres.
The Sabres. So
yeah.
Because I see them all the time for the Florida hockey teams, which is one of the most hilarious things on earth that Florida has a hockey team. But as an ending note, you know, beyond anything else, VetTix is awesome, and I'm on a mission to make sure all Marines or all vets are aware of it to take advantage of another one of those things we've earned.
Right. You know? Right. Right. It's not a handout.
Oh, hell no.
It's something that you've earned. Just like, I was talking to, my buddy, Paul, the first interview that I did, and I had been on him for years to try and get him to go and register at the VA and talk to someone about a claim and all that stuff.
I was feeling that. Listen, I'm there. I haven't. I have not because I've been blessed and I've worked hard and I, you know, I haven't needed things, but I saw what they did for my father-in-law, even though, you know, he was wealthy at a level, some of that wealth kind of waned in the final years, but, the VA really took care of him in the end. And so, yeah, I feel that same. So I would echo exactly your sentiment as a guy who has yet to do it at 52. Because listen, and you need to know too,
you should do it.
I thank God though, but listen, not to give the excuse, but our generation prior to yours and older hated the military.
The government itself.
And right. So we never wanted to take a handout.
Right.
Thank God, somewhere along the lines, and whoever it was that was able to do it as a group or as an individual, to reframe that as something that you deserve, that you've earned.
Right.
And by God, they need to do it.
Right.
They need to provide it.
Right.
And so we're all slowly, like your friend Paul and I, because I heard he's kind of my age. Yeah. We're all slowly coming around to that, right?
Yeah.
But you got to remember, most of us, even though, like, I was raised by kind of World War II Korean folks, you know, I say Depression era, but brothers, you know, their siblings, like Howard Jr., they were all Vietnam guys, right? So we were influenced, my generation, Gen X, was influenced by the Vietnam guys.
Right.
Who said, fuck the military, fuck the government, you know, fuck the VA, you know.
And I'll be the first one to admit, I was the same way when I got out of the Marine Corps in, what year, 2011? I got out in 2011. And I didn't want shit to do with the VA or the government. And it took me, I mean, I didn't register with the VA until like 5 or 6 years after the fact. So, but that was a lot of people like saying, hey, look, dude, you should, you know, you need to talk to somebody. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, this is what you need to do.
Yeah. All the benefits there. And, you know, I had a situation and a whole nother story, but, you know, I needed to go, I didn't really uncover, dig into, or work on my PTSD until about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, because of a whole other situation that happened. And it was really encouraged, you need to go to a counselor. So I went to a counselor, absent the VA, anything. I just paid for my own counselor. And he was the one who was like, you know, Shane, you have PTSD. Ah, fuck that. I'm a Marine. We don't have PTSD, whatever. And he goes, no. Your mistake, Shane, is that you think your PTSD started in the Marine Corps. Your PTSD started in childhood, brother. He said, you're telling me stories and you're laughing about them, and they're not funny stories.
Right.
He said, to the rest of the world, we are crying.
Yeah.
And to you, you're laughing.
Yeah.
That is a trauma response to PTSD.
Right.
So I've become aware more that, yes, okay, let's have these conversations. Like I began in the early, we got to tell somebody. I think it's too heavy of a burden for our children.
Yeah.
It's too heavy of a burden for my wife. She doesn't know the stories.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we've got to tell somebody. If not, it's a cancer that sits down inside and begins to eat us from the inside out. And it comes out in ways like alcoholism, drug addiction, violence, domestic violence. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to tell we don't want to tell our spouse, but we take it out on our spouse.
Right.
We don't want to tell our children, but we take it out on our children.
Right.
And so we've got to learn that it's not that we're bad. It's not something bad happened to us, but we've got to tell somebody. So we got to tell the people equipped to hear it. Right.
Right.
Counselor, you trained. Reminded me on a regular basis. I've been trained and been built to hear the worst of you.
Right. Trained professionals.
And I can handle this. I can process this, and I'm not going to take this personally.
Right.
But let me do this, you know, let me take it from you so that you can at least say it out loud. And so that was that journey. And I agree with you. And the VA would be a huge benefit to that. I'm at that point where I need another set of glasses. I've had glasses since I was 5 years old. And I'm like, you know what? Fuck paying for it this time. Let me get this VA stuff set up so I can have the VA give me some glasses.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah, for real.
And I wrestle with it. It's not because I need the VA too. That's the part we wrestle with. It's that, you know what? I see all these other motherfuckers in this country getting all this free shit.
Yeah.
And I've never wanted to jump on that bandwagon, but you know what? If anybody should be first in line, it should be vets.
And so the way it was explained to me a couple years ago was that it is a service that you earned, that we earned through our sacrifices to this country.
Right. I agree.
And when it was worded to me that way, I was like, that doesn't sound so bad, you know?
Yeah. I agree.
But anyone, any veteran that's out there, and you know, take it for whatever. But I understand where, you know, you guys and girls are coming from with not wanting to be a part of the VA and not trusting the government and all that stuff. But I've met some of the best people.
Yeah.
At the VA, you know, and it's not even like, I mean, just being a peer to somebody else, you know, a fellow right. veteran that might be struggling, you know, that day. I mean, just to, you know, sit down next to them and walk alongside them in this journey, like I said, speaks volumes. So, yeah, all that right. to say, and not to draw it out any longer than it needs to be drawn out, but that, you know, if you need help, you have to seek it. You have to seek it out. There are people out there, you know, at the VA, you know, in other organizations across this country that want to help veterans and see veterans succeed. So
absolutely. And we're losing too many brothers and sisters every day. Like, yep. I mean, you know, you may not, it just becomes a statistic, but listen, one of my dearest buddies, Godfrey, in the Marines, I mean, a badass human, one of my most favorite Marines to have served with, took his life a couple of years ago, and nobody saw it coming.
Yeah.
Devastated his family. Devastated them.
Yep.
And I don't believe to this day, had he known exactly how devastating it would have been to his family,
would he have still done it?
He wasn't that kind of character. He was a great guy, but he couldn't handle the shit we had to do.
Yeah.
And it eats at you. And he didn't belong in this world, man. He did. That was his viewpoint. So, yeah, if anybody out there struggling with it, man, you do belong. You deserve the help. You will absolutely crush your family and the people that care about you, including fellow Marines who knew you and loved you. I see my other dear buddy that the two of them were best friends. His name's Darren Flutie. I see him struggle with the loss of one of his closest friends on earth and the guy we shed blood and tears with, you know, and, you see him at 45, 50, you see him take themselves out.
Yep.
So yeah, get the help guys.
And it's, you know, remember all this, you are loved.
Yeah.
There are people in this world that love you, and
you're loved and you belong. You need to be here.
Yep.
And for that matter, you know, for a sense of purpose, your mission's not over.
Right.
There's a place for, you know, for my buddies. There's a place for Marines in this current world.
Yep.
If anything, to keep these other dipshits straight out here. Holy cow. Anyway, I love you, man. We should do our own podcast, the Johnson Boys.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be
just
cool.
Just talking about our life.
Life. Yeah. 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 That would be cool.
But a lot of fun, man. I love this. God, I hope you can keep this going. I want this because I love the mission of helping everyday veterans just tell their story.
Right.
We know the badasses stories, right? They're on podcasts every the biggest podcasts in the country.
Yeah.
Love them to death and we all watch them. But what about the everyday?
Right. Right.
Everyday vets who are just trying to make it every single day.
Yep. Yep.
So, I love this. Please keep it going.
I hope to keep it going. Yep. 100%. That's the plan.
Let me know how to support you.
Yes, sir. All right, brother. All right, y'all. Have a good day. Remember, again, you are loved. This is Mojo with Kojo. We'll catch you on the flip side.
Good night.